following was produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated in Memphis, Tennessee.
Hello, my name is Rick Cheddar, and this is From Radioland. Greetings, salutations, hello, how's it going? Welcome to another episode from Radioland from the home office in Memphis, Tennessee, where it's nippy and wet and weird. It's whatever it is. Buddy. Got a great show for you kids lined up here for episode number 200. A little program note. We had teased that we would have Mr. Josh McClain on in this episode. That's next week. Sorry, we had and you'll understand why when we get into the show this time out, because we've got a really cool guest and he's running on a little bit of a deadline, and to make it work, he's got a deadline coming up here that you can be a part of, and any rate, that's coming up. We'll get to that in a minute. It's Chance Raspberry on here. We'll tell you who he is in just a little while. I had an interesting weekend. Of course, last weekend we had Lightning Malcolm on the show, which was big fun. Heard from several folks who really enjoyed that show, and it was great. It was big fun, and it was one of those deals that I was out of town when we had released that episode. It was done on a scheduled deal. It was produced, it was ready to go, and it was automatically uploaded and done and such as it was, so that worked out well. The reason why that was is I was out of town. I had to I flew out of Memphis to Austin, Texas that week. It was a Thursday, and I was gone till about Sunday. And it's flying is such an interesting experience, you know. It really is. It's so different. It's not every time you go, there's this, okay, what's going to happen now? What am I going to get? I like to travel. It's the process by which that gets a little dicey. You know what I mean? A little shaky, a little weird. And flying out of Memphis is always a lot of fun because, well, I've never really had any issues with it. I say that, but next time I fly and I watch what happens, it's always been a good experience. And our airport's really quite cool. It's nice. I enjoy it. But you know, flying into Austin is what it is. And I flew in on a budget airline. Let you draw your own conclusions. And we landed in this place called Terminal South at the Austin Bergstrom International Airport. And it was kind of cool because you got off the plane, it was like in the old days, you get to actually come down outside, you walk out onto the tarmac. I mean, it's cool. It's a neat experience. And I was in Texas for visiting with family. And I did all that and got back on the plane for Sunday. I got back to the airport on Sunday to fly out. And I had a screener moment. I had a TSA moment. I was assaulted. is a good way to put this. You know, when you go through the process, and you're at the screener's station there, you know, you go see the front guy. The front guy is the guy who, he's the first one you encounter. And, you know, he wants your boarding pass, and he wants your ID, make sure everything lines up. And that was all well and good. He was a very pleasant fellow. There was a bit of a line, nothing horrendous. I was waiting for that line to clear, and I had some small talk with the agent from the TSA, and he was, you know, very pleasant, very nice guy. I mean, we literally talked about the weather because it was foggy that day. So anyway, my turn comes up, and I have to go over to the little conveyor belt thing where they have all the buckets, you know, all the stuff you put your stuff in. I had a carry-on bag, and inside that bag is, you know, your bathroom bag. The old guys would call that a dop kit. You know, you have your soap, your shampoo, your toothpaste, your deodorant, you know, your stuff. So they said, well, you need to open that up and pull that out of there and put that in another bag aside. You know, you have to. They don't do that in Memphis, but they do in Austin. And then I had my other carry-on, which was my man bag, if you will. There's more on the man bag coming up, trust me with this. And in there, I've got a laptop and a tablet. And, of course, I have my phone. And I had to empty your pockets. You got to take your belt off, take your shoes off. You're separated from everything except for you and your pants and your shirt. That's about it. And I'm standing in the little line. There's like three or four people in front of me. There was another five or six behind me at this point. And I have to go through the machine. The machine, of course, is the big full body scanner, the thing that costs like $500,000 a piece. And you stand there and you face a certain way and you put your feet over these little spots on the thing, and you hold your hands over your head. You're in a very weird prone position, and this thing takes a picture of you using some type of backscatter technology, and they can see through your stuff. They see through your clothes. They're looking at your junk or whatever it is that they're doing, and whatever it is that they're looking for. And immediately, this guy on the other side of the machine commences to barking at me and wants me to step out of the machine immediately, of which I complied, of course. And I know the drill. You stand there, you hold your hands out, they run the wand over you, and then they just want to verify that it is, in fact, a bracelet you're wearing or a necklace or something. So he proceeds to tell me that there was a problem with my pants, of which I, at this point, had immediately jumped right into sarcasm mode and said that my pants fit fine. Thank you for checking. It turned out that that was not the end of his concern for me. They ran the swab over my hands. The swab is it looks like one of them wet naps that you get at a barbecue joint. And they run that over your hands. They're looking for, bomb-making material, gunpowder, whatever, some questionable stuff. And that was all fine, of course. And then he says he's got to stick his finger in my pants, which I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be interesting. And which he goes around my waistband. Of course, there's nothing there, I'm not a terrorist. I'm not somebody. I'm probably on a list now after way. And he says to me, we can go do this in private if you'd like. And I said, what? And deprive all of these people of a great show? I said, hell no. I need witnesses. You separated me from my phone. Let's get busy and figure out what's going on here. So he proceeds to tell me he's got to frisk me at this point. It's an aggressive pat down. Those of you who have had this can understand exactly what I'm talking about. Except I got a little added bonus out of the deal. Got a Christmas goose a little early, you see. He goes around behind me, and he grabs my ankles with both hands and begins to slide his hands up my pants, up my leg, all the way to the top of my leg where it meets my butt. His hands are upon me, you see. And of course, I'm just using the back of my hand. He's trying to talk me through it like it's making me feel any better. My dignity is shot at this point. He does both legs, on the back. And then he moves around to my front and does the same thing. Now, at this point, I'm looking at him. I'm making eye contact with this guy. And he gets all the way up. He grabs me by my balls. And he takes, I guess, what I assume to be his middle finger and proceeds to toss my salad. I don't know what the hell he's looking for. He sure shit didn't find nothing because I ain't got nothing there. And, of course, I'm smarting off to the guy. Find that bug my wife says is in there? He's getting a little testy with me, pardon the pun, and he realizes now that there's nothing to be found, I suppose. And he sends me on my way, of which I have to go past him. But keep in mind, there's several agents that are standing around watching all this go down. I had been singled out. So I go to the thing, and I put my belt back onto my pants. I put my shoes back on. I proceed to put everything back in my stuff. And I'm taking my time at this point because the terminal that I was at, it's only got three gates. So, and I could see the gate I was going to. It was right there. And I'm like, screw this. I'm just going to take my time, and I'm gonna put my stuff back together after having just been violated. And, of course, I take it into a, I take these things with a bit of a grain of salt. A lot of people probably wouldn't. having been in the business that I have been in all these years, you tend to just let stuff like this roll off your back. You know, you just kind of go with it. I have nothing to hide. Apparently, I'm free of testicular cancer, and apparently my prostate is working well. So that was all good news at this point. But nevertheless, once I was able to kind of compose myself and move over to the gate, I was then approached by a couple of gentlemen that were behind me in the line. I did not really pay much attention to. They were very nice gentlemen. They were also flying back to Memphis, and they said, "Man, when they did to you what they did to you, they owe you a blowjob," is what he told me. And then secondly, he said that they all sailed right through security. So obviously I was, you know, who's the long-haired freaky guy over here with the mustache, the questionable facial hair? We're going to have a chat with him. He's obviously up to no good. And I'm dressed business casual at this point, because I know if I'm going to go through and just, you know, jeans and a t-shirt, it's not going to go well for anybody. I'm just going to look weird. So I was with family, for Christ's sakes. So it all happens. I get through there, and he goes, "Well, you want to sit down?" I'm like, "No, my butt's a little, you know, I just got fisted by the TSA. So if you'll just pardon me, I'm going to just kind of stand here for a bit." So anyway, long story short, I got on the plane. It was all, I guess it was an incident. Nonetheless, it happened. Just be mindful if you're going to be traveling this holiday season and you get pointed out. Just remember, we just had this conversation, and you can expect them to be, quote unquote, a little more aggressive with their searching. Keep that in mind. And there's nothing you can do about it, because their answer is always going to be, "Well, you don't have to fly. You take the bus, you take the train, take a boat, you can walk, you can drive a car. You have options, you see." Nevertheless, such as it is, it's all behind me now, except for those loving memories of, well, I didn't even get the guy's name, for God's sake. So anyway, look, kids, we got a great show for you this time out. Got a fantastic conversation we're going to have with a good friend of ours, good friend of the radio station, Mr. Chance Raspberry. Chance is, he's from the Memphis area, and he is currently living out in Burbank, California, works in Los Angeles. He is he's a character layout guy and animator for The Simpsons television show. You might have seen this show on Fox. He does all the stuff. He makes the magic happen. He's an Emmy award winning animator. He's a great guy. He's got a brand new project he's working on. Hence is why he is on this week. And we're going to be talking with him about all of the fun stuff about The Simpsons, how they make that show. It's an eye-opening experience to understand exactly how each episode has come together. But it's a fun show. So not only are we going to have that conversation with him, we're going to hear some of his music. That's right. He's also a musician, so we're going to play a tune from him. So it's big fun with Chance Raspberry here on this episode from Radioland.
Keep calm and haunt on with Historical Haunts, Memphis Haunted Tour Company, Ancient Burial Mounds, Yellow Fever, Maritime Disasters, Victorian Murders, and Ghost Stories are all a part of the Memphis Dark History. Join Historical Haunts for a spirited night out on the Haunted Memphis Bus Tour, Haunted Pub Crawl, the Woodruff Fontaine House Ghost Tour, or one of our other spooky tours and events. Check out our website for all of the exciting ghost tours and ghost haunts at historicalhauntsmemphis.com.
My guest this time out is a longtime friend of Radio Memphis, a friend of mine as well, a great guy all the way around. If you've spent any time around a television, you've seen his work, especially if it comes to spending any time with that lovely American family, The Simpsons. The Emmy award-winning animator himself, Mr. Chance Raspberry, joins us by phone from Los Angeles, California. Well, Burbank, is that right?
That's right. Thanks for having me, Rick. It's awesome to be on the show.
Well, man, I appreciate you taking the time to do it. And it's been crazy, you guys out there out west in L.A., the whole city seems to be on fire.
Yeah, you know, I woke up actually from like a nap, because I've been staying up all night working lately, and the house just smelled like smoke. I thought, well, you know, I hope my house isn't on fire. And I'm like trying to figure out what's going on, and then I step outside and there's ash raining from the sky. This was just, I think, day before yesterday, and the whole, you know, turn on the news, the alerts and everything. So yeah, there's a lot of fire here, and it's it's been spreading around the northern mountain range on the San Fernando Valley where I live. But it seems to be moving rapidly in a different direction. I'm not sure if that's because they're herding it that way with the firefighters,
yeah,
or what. But it's been nuts.
It's kind of scary, I would imagine. I mean, I hope that your home and all of that is safe.
Well, thanks, man. Yeah, it is, because I kind of live sort of more in the center of the valley where I'm pretty much just surrounded by concrete. So, we've got parks and stuff, but they're all so far enough away from the mountain range that we don't really have to worry about the wind blowing the flames and having them jump over to where we are. So, but thank you for that, man. I got some friends who live out where the fire is happening, and so I'm keeping them in my prayers. We're kind of all on alert. I told everybody that's in that area that they need help, just give me a shout and I'll come running.
Sure. Yeah. Some of the video that has come out, there was some footage that somebody had shot with their dash cam on their car, and they're going down the 405, and it's just very surreal looking, it's just like, something almost like out of a video game or a movie.
Yeah. I mean, whenever I see that kind of stuff where you've got like either the glow of the flames, especially at night, and then it's just like killer. I mean, just like the sky is nothing but smoke. It reminds me of something out of Middle Earth. You got like Lord of the Rings or something.
Yeah. I'm not laughing at the situation. I'm just laughing at the imagery of that because it seems to be very accurate.
Yeah, it is, man. I mean, it's I agree with you 100%. Like, it's not funny, but it does bear a very sort of startling but also interesting and somewhat humorous resemblance to those fantasy stories, and but it's a crazy situation. So I'm really hoping that everything gets under control here pretty soon.
Yeah,
we got a great fire department out here, so they're really battling it. They've got all hands on deck.
Oh well, yeah, they're used to fighting these sorts of fires. The Santa Ana winds are a little hotter this time of year, it seems, and they're just whipping this thing up into a frenzy. I hope everything works out for you. It sounds like you're in a pretty good safe spot, though.
Yeah, thanks.
You were talking about, now you work in LA, but you, I think you said you live in Burbank. I've been to both. Burbank is actually kind of cool. I dig that little burg. It seems like it's where all the I think a lot of production people live out in that area. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. There's a lot of the industry. Burbank is Hollywood's backyard. So it's literally just over the southern mountain range of the San Fernando Valley. And so, I mean, there's a couple of little back roads that will take you in just, 15, 20 minutes. Obviously, if there's no traffic,
right,
you can get over that hill real quick. And then, boom, you're in Hollywood. So there's a lot of people that work in Hollywood or L.A. or downtown, but they live in Burbank and vice versa. And the heart and the birthplace of the animation industry is right here. So it's a wonderful place to be. I mean, the Simpsons animation is produced here. You have everything within, like, in fact, the building I'm in right now making this call from is the Animation Academy. And it's the school I went to where I, sort of really honed my skills to break into the industry. And you've got from the roof of this place, especially, on a clear day, you can look in, it's like right in the center. You can just look in a 360 degree circle and see Disney, Warner Brothers, Universal, Simpsons, Cartoon Network, Nickelodeon, like every animation studio is right around here.
Oh, that's wild. That's beautiful. That's absolutely fantastic. How long have you been working with the Simpsons? You're a character animator. Is that right? Is that your official title with them?
Yeah, it's technically character layout artist, and I eventually work my way up to lead character layout artist. And, a lot of people, when you tell them that, they don't really know what it means. And so when you start trying to explain it, they don't always have time to really hear the whole thing. So I just say I'm a character animator or a lead animator, and they kind of like get it right away. Oh, okay, cool. So I've been working at doing that job now for 11 years. I got started back in 2006.
Wow. That's and the show, of course, has been on since I think I Love Lucy went off the air. The Simpsons is just a powerhouse of television.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, we're even a little bit, stunned as the crew that it's we're going on the 30th season right now. You know, I mean, we're producing 29, but I know they already signed a contract for season 30. So we're just hoping that, you know, if for no other reason than job security, we hope it just keeps on going.
Oh yeah, God, I could relate to that. I mean, because, you know, in this industry, as you know, showbiz is tricky when it comes to any type of job security, and to have a gig that that is this strong and this stable all this time is that's a nice blessing to have.
Amen, man. It really, really is. And, you know, and the thing is, too, I mean, the show still makes me laugh out loud. You know, I know it's not what it was back in its glory days in the golden age of The Simpsons, you know, seasons 1 through 8 or 10, like, in my opinion, when it was really shining. But it still has great writers and great scripts and a great crew. And every episode gives me at least one or two laugh out loud moments where I'm just like, my gosh, that was a good one.
So how does this work then? Do the actors go into the studio and they lay out their lines, and then you guys are given that, and then you work, you animate to that, you lay out, you do all your artwork to that, or is it the other way around?
No, you nailed it, man. They a lot of people think, because of portrayals in movies and stuff, that, you know, the artists will do the animation and then the voice actor has to kind of like match that with the performance, and that's pretty much impossible, because it has to all sync up very, very accurately, and you can't, you know, really anticipate what the drawings are going to do. There's no real way to feel or predict that. So they'll record everything and just give it it's basically a radio show. They'll just give it their best performance. Then we get the audio and we just try to make the characters act exactly how the dialogue sounds.
Oh, I see how that works then. So, yeah, the reason why I asked this is that there was an interview that I saw somewhere on YouTube with Mel Blanc, the man of 1,000 voices himself, and he was asked a very similar question about that, and we're talking about those old Bugs Bunny cartoons that he was so famous for, and he was talking about how those animators back then, back in the, I guess it was like the 40s and 50s, they were doing full animation by hand, and he said that those, I think it was a 7-minute short, took on the, along the lines of like 9 months to produce. And I would assume that, you know, here we are in 2017, that technology, of course, computers are a big part of all of this, that we've shaved some time off of that.
Well, let's I'm glad you brought that up, Rick, because let's talk about that for a second. The difference is very interestingly minimal. And why I say that is the animation that I heard a wonderful comparison to start answering that question from Bob Clampett, also of Termite Terrace and Looney Tunes. And he said that an animated short, 6 to 7 minutes long, being produced in the 1940s at Looney Tunes, contained over 100,000 drawings, 100,000 frames of animation.
Holy cow.
Like, yeah, that's how many drawings it was, you know, everything was super fluid. Almost every drawing was, you know, exposed only once or twice on the film. And the longer you expose, you know, the more frames you expose the drawing, the less drawings you have to do to make up that much time on screen. So, basically you had all this, I mean, that's why they're all super fluid and smooth and bouncy in the golden age of animation. And Disney is the same. You know, everything was just that high quality and at that standard. Now, that's 7 minutes, 6 to 7 minutes with 100,000 drawings. And now on TV and pretty much everything you see, you know, it's just go with the episode format. A 30-minute show contains probably less than half that. There are about 30 to 40,000, maybe 50,000 drawings for a half hour. So the amount of drawings has been decreased significantly. However, the amount of time it takes to produce that much content has not changed. One episode of The Simpsons from script to screen is about a 9-month production process.
Really? That's forever.
Right. And people go, well, wait a minute. How are they airing them every single week? And they, you know, if it takes 9 months per episode. So the way that works is when they produce season one, they had almost a whole season done before it started airing. So as far as production is concerned, they're almost a full season ahead of schedule. So you have a bit of a cushion there. And then, of course, you know, now there's all of this, you know, manpower. You've got large crews here in the States doing pre-production, and then we do layout, which is the first phase of animation production, and we're the only studio that still does that in America. Then we ship the layouts and the storyboards and all the elements to the South Korean studio, and they do all the heavy lifting, all the in-betweens and the rough animation. They take it all and break it down, clean it up, color it. And that's, you know, for every one drawing we do, they probably do 10.
Okay,
so,
that makes sense.
Or more.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you're basically laying out, as your job would imply, you're the layout guy. So you're laying out how the scene would go, if you will. And so you've got just a few of the frames in there, and then they come in and fill in those blanks and make it fluid and smooth, right?
Exactly. Yeah, a way I like to explain it is we create the dots, and then the overseas studio connects the dots, and we just do those main beats, those key poses, which is what the animation directors at Looney Tunes and back in the good old days would do. The directors were actually the key animators, and they would, that's why everything was so very, you know, defined and specific, and all those great, insane, exaggerated actions and movements that we remember from Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck were so specific and memorable, because the director themselves were literally imagining like every move, and then someone else would come in and take their cues and go with it. So yeah, we do that, and we have all that animation being done, and so then what we get back is the finished color version of it. But you know, that's how we're able to do it in 9 months, and no more than 9 months, is because you have thousands of people as opposed in the Korean studio, as opposed to the hundreds that are working here in the U.S. And so it's literally a crew of, you know, thousands, if not tens of thousands of people that it takes to get it done in that amount of time. So you can basically have all episodes of the season being produced at the same time by different crews.
Okay, I see. That makes sense then. So yeah, putting that 9 months into perspective, when you divide it across an army like that, it significantly changes the time, because The Simpsons and I think shows like Family Guy and other, they get into timely references that are you know, pretty much of the moment, and you wonder, knowing that it takes so long to produce these shows, that they're able to get those those influences in there because they have such a massive group of people working on the show.
Right, and there's actually, that's another, I don't know if it's a secret, but it's definitely, you know, one of those inside pieces of information. There's a department, and I'm sure they have this at every show, called retakes, where once the color screening comes back and it's completely done, it's still not ready to air, because there's a lot of things that usually need to be tweaked or fixed or tightened up, and that's one of those areas is, you know, the show might have a joke that was relevant to something in pop culture 9 months ago, but now it's not. So they'll either go in and completely reanimate a scene, or they will just, I'm sure you've noticed this a lot in animation, sometimes it looks like the character's mouth all of a sudden just stops syncing up to the word.
Yes, yes.
But only for like a line or two. So what that was, they went in and they said, okay, we don't have time to reshoot this, or it's not worth the money it's going to cost. We're just going to overdub it. We're going to have the voice actor re-record something that's more relevant, and forget if it doesn't match up. Well, you know, the audience will deal with it, or they won't notice, and who cares? And that was something that always drew my attention to it as a kid. And I was like, well, I wonder why that one part didn't work. And I realize it does work, but it's working in this weird sort of like makeshift fashion of fixing something so that it was all for the relevance of the joke.
Right, 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 right. Yeah, so you're able to, you know, get a little bit more mileage out of your footage too.
Exactly.
Now, obviously, with computers in the scene now, you're not necessarily having to do this by hand anymore, thank God. But when you're working with computers, you're still creating a lot of work, but is it a little easier, you think, now using the digital technology as opposed to sitting down with pen and paper?
Well, you know, that's another excellent question, and I'm glad you brought that up, because yes, we are using computers, but the way that the cartoons are made is still exactly the same. At least on The Simpsons, we have to draw every frame by hand. So we've got those Cintiq tablets by Wacom that where you actually draw on the screen just like you would on paper with a stylus.
Right.
And we use animation software, and it technically speeds things. Here's what I would say. It doesn't make things faster, but it gives you a lot more flexibility and a lot more options. If we save time anywhere, it's in being able to adjust and fix things. But as far as like actually creating the content from scratch, that's all still done the exact same way traditionally by hand, where we're actually hand drawing every frame. We're just doing it digitally with these stylus tablets. And what's interesting, and this is something that still blows my mind, the Simpsons, once they ship everything to Korea, the Korean studio will take our digital files and print them onto paper and punch the paper so that it can go on those animation pegs, and they literally still animate all the in-between by hand on paper like they did back in 1930s.
Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work. That's a lot of work.
And that's why it takes an army and why animation is so time-consuming and expensive, and a lot of people... You know, it's just, this is not common knowledge, and I love being able to share this with people and really kind of get this understanding of how animation works and why it's so, you know, really, you know, a magical art form, but that's also a very, you know, sacrificial art form. You have to give a ton of energy and, you know, of yourself into doing this art, and it's the greatest art form of all time ever conceived by man. You know, it takes everything that, you know, every other art form offers and, you know, basically brings it together in this perfect combination, and it creates like an outcome that is so much more impacting and memorable, at least in, you know, sort of an audiovisual sense, than any other art form you can come up with. It takes it all, you know, all the best of everything else and rolls it into one. So you know, the other thing that is really worth mentioning about that creative process is when they do it all on paper, they have to actually go scan it all back into the computer to keep it in line with our digital production flow. So it's actually creating more work just to keep the show looking like it did in the glory days when it was all done on paper.
Yeah, it's the consistency end of it. So this has always fascinated me as well. Anybody that works on the show, I guess they have to learn how to draw like Matt Groening, right?
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. We have model sheets, and we, you know, have these very specific, you know, like spelled out ways to draw the characters. Every character has rules and methods and steps and, you know, features. So there's all these measurements that you sort of get down second nature and memorize, and learning those takes months. I mean, even when you're working on the show and you're learning, you know, sort of like trial by fire, it just takes time before, you know, it's that 10,000 hour rule before it becomes second nature. And, they're very deceptively complicated and difficult and challenging to draw. And yet, Matt Groening he created the characters and look of the show. David Silverman then refined all the models and the design for what it became when it went to a full series in 1990. And then over the years, as I'm sure everyone has noticed, the characters have evolved into the way they look today. And the interesting irony there is that every once in a while, more often than you would expect, I have directors telling me, like, you know, you're drawing the characters a little too on model. Like, you know, loosen up a little bit. And what I think they really mean is, like, we want you to, you know, try to keep that stuff a little looser, a little more bouncy, give it some life. And it's still funny to me because I think, like, well, if we're not supposed to draw them like they're, you know, the model sheets, then what do we do? There's like an infinite number of other possibilities.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, if you take somebody like Homer Simpson and, you know, everybody knows what he looks like and a way he's supposed to look and the way he looks when he's facing Marge or when he, and he turns and he looks down or he's looking up or he's in motion. Those are all those rules that you're talking about that you have to, I guess, kind of stick to. But what you're telling me is like, oh, lighten it up a little bit, Chance. Give him a little more movement here.
Yeah, exactly. And they'll, you know, the only thing that really, like, you know, I guess we ask as animators is, like, just tell us how you want us to deviate, and we're cool, and we can do it all day long, you know? And that keeps the job fun and fresh and interesting. It's just nice to have that good direction. It's nice when we can have a little bit more flexibility with the characters. And, cause, you know, it's a script driven show. So usually whatever is written, we're not supposed to deviate from. And there's strict rules about that. In fact, when I first got hired, I used to write jokes. Like, I would just, like, decide that it would be funnier if Homer did this. So he's supposed to wave. So, but the way he says yoo-hoo and he waves from his truck, you know, and the way he said yoo-hoo in the audio sounded very effeminate to me.
Uh-huh.
So I thought, wouldn't it be funny if, like, he, like, pulls a handkerchief or, like, some, you know, something from his pocket and sort of waves it almost like a princess or like an old fashioned, you know, damsel from the 1800s. And, you know, my director, it was just one of those scenarios where they're just like, oh, Chance, like, you know, you're going to be the death of us. That we like this and we think it's funny, you know, or at least it works, but you can't do that because the writers didn't write it. And it's like, really?
They're
going to
freak out. That's not what was in the script. That's not what we had in mind.
Right. And the director, if the director makes that call, they can get away with it usually. But as an artist, it's like, you just sort of have to pitch your concept for something and see if they go for it. Every once in a while, they'll say, just do it. Like, if anybody says anything, you know, I'll tell them it was my idea. So it's a great team. It's a lot of collaboration and fun.
Yeah, it does sound like it's a good time. I mean, that's the one thing about what you get to do for a living is you get to be involved in a great show, but at the same time, you're working with a great bunch of people, and it's just a fine time. I don't know, it's got its stresses. Every job has that. But at the same time, it's just like, man, look what I get to do for a living.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. And, you know, the stress, you know, you're right. It comes with the territory. I tell people, you know, if you didn't love animation or love to draw, and I mean love, like, in the most pure, extreme sense of the word, like, you need to do this to simply be happy existing or simply feel like content being alive. This is something like air. You need it every single day because it's your life's blood and your life's passion. Like, if you don't feel that strongly about animation, you like no amount of money would make it worth it, because it's such a hair pulling out, like, you know, racking your brain, problem solving, juggling act, like, every single day. And I don't mean that in a bad way. This is realistically what it requires. Because it, like I said before, it takes every other art form and combines it into one fluid code. It's like a machine. So you have all these very specific gears, like the inside of a clock, that are working in unison. And if one gear is even off at the slightest bit, it throws everything else off. So you're constantly having to keep track and juggle and make sure that doesn't happen. Everything stays together and doesn't fall apart.
Yeah, it is a monumental undertaking that it does take a special person to do. And I'm glad that you're doing it, because, you know, as I say, you know, once you get to do what you do and you like doing it, you never work a day in your life. You know, you're out there just having fun and doing what you're doing, you know.
Exactly, and that makes all the challenges worthwhile. You know, I mean, because you're right. You love it. It even when it feels like work, it still feels fulfilling, and it brings you that joy that you're reaching for and searching for in life. And it's very much that. You know, it delivers that more than anything else I know. This just the way I'm wired. I love to create, and you know, despite the fact that you have to do 1,000,000,000 drawings, you know, to make a movie. And I think that was actually, like, I think, you know, like an 80-minute feature film usually has anywhere from 1.5 to 2 million drawings. We're talking like a Disney feature, but any film. So yeah, it's just that manpower and that labor that's involved, but it's worth it.
Well, which brings me to this. I mean, you've described this incredible task of putting together a program. And now you're working on something, your own thing here called Little Billy. And, you know, and I'm sitting there listening to what you're talking, describing about how a show like The Simpsons is done, and you're obviously an expert in all of this, and you're looking at doing a whole brand new show. You're going to be assembling that army yourself now for something new, right?
Exactly. You know, and it's true, Rick. The word army is not used it to excess. I mean, it's not an understatement or an overstatement, I should say. It's definitely what it requires. And so, yeah, I'm currently trying to produce a new animated series, Little Billy. It's the world's first animated series about life with a neurodiversity, special needs, and the power of being different. And I want to bring this message of inclusion and awareness that it's okay to stand out and be different and not be like everybody else, through a real sort of like entertaining prime time vessel of deliverance, you know, of delivery of this message. And so, the thing is, like, we're talking about The Simpsons, so we can use that as a nice comparison. The Simpsons is the same format, half hour primetime sitcom. And, it's, you know, animated. It's not what I would consider truly limited animation, because things are round and voluminous and they animate, you know, they don't sort of jump and pop like some of the older cartoons from UPA, where, you know, it was all about being graphic and iconic, and it wasn't so much about this very lifelike fluid animation. What I want to do is take that primetime format and that approach that The Simpsons takes, but I want to take the animation style back to Looney Tunes and back to Disney in the 40s. So it's kind of a crazy notion, because they say, well, you know, gosh, it takes us 9 months to produce a half hour episode without doing all of the, you know, that those drawings, all that mass number of, like, you know, 100,000 drawings for 7 minutes. You want to do three times, so that's 300,000 drawings for 21 minutes, which is about what a half hour becomes when you add in commercials.
Sure.
You know, so it's like, you know, it's a real massive undertaking, but it's definitely worthwhile, because I don't feel like, first of all, it's where my heart's at, you know, and I love that old style of animation, but also I feel like, and I know this, you know, from experience, that the message is delivered more powerfully and more memorably when the quality is there. So I want to, you know, keep that animation quality standard that they had in the 40s with Disney and Looney Tunes intact and alive today.
It's brilliant. It's absolutely a brilliant idea. I mean, because I you know, the Looney Tunes stuff, all the Merry Melodies, all the Tex Avery stuff, Chuck Jones, all those cats. It seemed like when you could watch those shows, you could almost read their lips, you know?
Right. They're so very, like, defined and fluid. And, I mean, everybody uses the word timeless. You know, timeless is how Walt Disney is described. And Looney Tunes definitely falls into that category as well. And, I mean, that's the reason, is because all of those expressions were invented, you know? And they're larger than life. So they take the way we feel, and they put it, like, give it a visual context. And so you can look at something and it affects your mood. It affects your emotions in the moment, like immediately. And so that's what I want Little Billy to do. And the reason I'm taking this approach is because as a kid growing up with Tourette syndrome, I was diagnosed at age 8. And, but before that, of course, I was still exhibiting the behavior, and that's why Little Billy is a show about neurodiversity and special needs, and, you know, because this is my life. I lived this, and so I gave Billy this fictitious condition so that it wouldn't just be relevant to people with Tourette syndrome. So he's got something called UHS, which I made up. It stands for ultra hypersensitivity, and it's basically a medley of different symptoms from all the different neurodiversities out there. So he has a little ADHD, a little Tourette syndrome, a little OCD, autism, you name it. And a lot of the conditions that we're talking about are that way in real life. You know, usually if people are diagnosed with one, they're diagnosed with two or three of those other ones. It's actually less uncommon than people realize. And so another thing I want to bring, you know, awareness to and shed some light on, as well as sort of like shed light on a lot of the stereotypes and, you know, the way things really are, and maybe get a little bit of that, you know, stigma out of the way and out of the public eye, as well as out of the mindsets of the people that actually possess these conditions and who are sort of being involuntarily programmed by society and by the media to view themselves a certain way. So with little Billy, I want to show them, like, look at this character. Look, he's only 4 years old. I mean, he's just the most innocent, pure, carefree, oblivious child imaginable, with the most energy of any human being ever exist. And basically, you know, his energy borders superhuman. I'm taking everything I went through as a child and exaggerating it to 11 to, and then to like 1100. And because that's what animation is all about. And that's what makes it so much fun is we remember all those great expressions and poses from Bugs Bunny because they're insane and they're super exaggerated. And that makes the funny even funnier. And it makes the moving, you know, even that much more emotional. And that's why we remember and hold on to and embrace all this stuff, because it made us feel something. And we never forget, you know, being moved, like when our souls and our hearts are actually like touched. And that's what I want to do with this cartoon, because as a kid with Tourette's, going through all of this up to age 8, I didn't have that diagnosis. And so no one really knew what to do with me. That was just like, oh, well, Chance, you know, that's just Chance. He's the problem child. He's acting out, you know, as a result, you know, I was misunderstood. I'm sure everyone can relate to this in some degree, And that's another thing that makes Little Billy great, is the universal aspect that we've all felt left out or rejected, or like we didn't fit in at some point in our lives for some reason. And he represents all of that. And so because I didn't have those friends and those people who understood me, I sort of turned to my passion. I turned to what made me happy, which was drawing and film and animated film specifically. My parents, God bless them, it really all starts with them. They were the ones who nurtured my love for cartoons and my love for art and wanting to draw. And so they would just feed me all of the cartoons that they grew up loving, with Looney Tunes, Disney, Fleischer, Tex Avery, you know, Tom and Jerry, you name it, all of it. And then of course I discovered here's what's amazing about all this, the era that I grew up in, the 1980s, which is why the show is set in the 80s, was the second golden age of animation. So the stuff that was being produced during my childhood was pushing for that caliber that was being produced in the first golden age, which is basically the 30s through the 50s. And when they pioneered the art form from scratch. So you have this amazing, amazing resurgence of animation quality in both the production value and the art and the story and the storytelling. And so those emotions and that really drastic narrative and that ability to like tell a story that you'll never forget, I was saturated by it again. So it was like I got to reconnect with the golden age through the second golden age that I lived through as a child. And of course, during those magical years, you're so influential and impressionable and vulnerable as a child. And so it's like that much more powerful and magical. And those are my first friends, my cartoons and my toys and my pencils.
Oh, God, yeah.
Sit by myself. Just draw, man. Yeah,
absolutely. No, I can relate. And if you and I kind of came up in sort of the same line when you know that television was like the ultimate babysitter. You know, it's right. And you make these connections with these characters, and especially if they are somewhat like you. And I am assuming that the show Little Billy is kind of targeted to a younger audience, but I'm sure it'll have something for adults as well. That you'll be able to shoot jokes over the kids' heads and land them in mom and dad's lap.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the plan. That's what Looney Tunes did so well. And I love the idea of, you know, because it's set in the 80s, everyone who is roughly my age and they're, you know, would say like maybe 30s, mid early to mid 30s or older, will remember like, oh man, like this, yeah, I remember. I want to give them that feeling of like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. And it was, yay, I am so glad I remember, because how cool was that toy or that song or that cartoon? And yeah, you do. You establish a connection and a relationship with those characters, and then the connection stays with you, even if, when you forget about it. As soon as that spark reminds you, it's like, whoa, it comes flooding back, and it's that exhilarating feeling of like nostalgia and that memory of what was magic to you as a child, what you loved once, and to reconnect with that. And so, yes, it'll appeal to both the parents in that way and to a much younger audience of, like, you know, toddlers basically. And, which is when we sort of start to become aware that we have an identity. And then to everyone in between, you know, when you basically it'll be like, oh man, yeah, I remember, you know, the struggles I went through, and wow, you know, that's, it's cool. Like this, or maybe kids are going through that stuff right now, and they can watch this character and see how Billy deals with, you know, bullying, or how he deals with any challenge in a world that didn't have this big sense of awareness and the internet where you could just go and connect with your people or find a support group or call, you know, I mean, there was none of that kind of stuff when I was a kid. There were, you know, maybe there was a hotline, and or like a, you know, like a place where you could go to have like a meeting, but you know, finding these places, which were so few and far between, was next to impossible given the fact that there was no internet, there were no cell phones. You just had to kind of ask people, and you know, go down, hey, you know, go to work and talk to your friend or a parent at school and see if you can find stuff out. And I love the idea of sharing, you know, like a world where it makes people grateful for the resources they have now, but it also shows what people can do when they're not bound by or dependent on technology and the limitations of this like endless resource where you actually have to get creative and use your imagination.
Oh yeah, that's God. I grew up in a time when you were sent into the backyard with a stick and a rock, and you know, and you that was your fun time, you know. But your imagination, man. Your imagination comes into play, and that's. In fact, I just read the other day that there are some, children's psychologists now are saying that children that grow up with lesser toys, you know, or toys that don't have that are as functional as you would think, actually develop a stronger sense of a independence, and creativity was a huge thing.
Yeah, because you have to invent not only what that character is and how it, I mean, you basically have to invent everything, you know, like, okay, well, this is a toy that has, like, you know, maybe it's an action figure with arms and legs, and the head turns a little bit, and the legs have, like, a joint that bends at the hips and the shoulders. And so you're extremely limited with what that toy can do. Doesn't have anything digital. It doesn't have batteries. It doesn't, you know, make noise or light up. And so what you have to do is create everything, you know, your story, your adventure, the personality, the mission of the character. And then you can just go to town. I mean, what's cool is once you're able, you know, to have that connection to your own imagination, the sky's the limit, and you tap into this world of limitless possibilities, and it's so much fun. And it's almost, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's more fun than having everything fed to you predetermined, because you have no options. I mean, you can decide and choose how you're going to interpret what you're being fed, but it's all spelled out for you. And in this case, you know, with the time we grew up, you had a lot more, you know, I guess, like, more of a challenge and ability and opportunity to not just be more creative, but also have more fun with your creativity.
Oh, certainly, yeah. So, where are you at here on the show now? What's your current status with Little Billy? Where are you standing on this show?
Well, I've got a trailer for the pilot episode that's currently done, and it's online at littlebilly.com, which is the Indiegogo page. And right now, the Indiegogo for the project is currently running. It has 10 days left, including today. So it ends December 16th at 11:59 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So anybody who wants to check it out can go to either littlebilly.com, or you can go to Indiegogo and search Little Billy. What I'm trying to do is raise $10,000 to fund just a new animated short, something real quick and simple that just gives people more of Little Billy and the character and maybe a couple other characters, you know, maybe his parents or a friend or two. And really, I just want to create new content for the series that tells the story more, that gets everything we're talking about here tonight kind of out on the screen and in this nice little package for people to experience and share. And it comes with all kinds of perks and, you know, merchandise. There's t-shirts, posters, trading card stickers. And then I've gotten other artists from other shows on board. Speaking of all this, you know, golden age and 1980s stuff, I mean, that's really the driving force. So the main poster for the series, which is what kicked off the campaign on Indiegogo, is painted by one of the top current Garbage Pail Kids painters.
Oh.
Because I wanted it to...
Yeah.
I wanted it to feel, I mean, I didn't just want it to feel like a massive tribute or love letter to the 1980s. I wanted it to actually feel like it came from the 80s and it's legitimately made in that time and we just missed it. So figure what better way to do that than to go to the actual guys who paint these cards. And I got my favorite artist from them today, Joe Simcoe, to do the poster. It's one of the main images of the campaign you'll see, and you'll know when you see it because it's painted in the same Series 1 Garbage Pail Kids style from 1985, and it's a tribute or a reference to the iconic atom bomb car where the kid's head is exploding with the mushroom cloud, and
yeah.
It was like super controversial. But that was actually the very first painting that John Pound ever did. I mean, that's the first Garbage Pail Kid ever painted. Like, a lot of people don't realize that because it's not number one. It's like number eight in the series. So, but it's from series one, and I wanted that look. And so I got all that stuff. I got my mentor, who actually runs the school I'm at right now, the Animation Academy. His name is Charles Mbilis. And he was actually one of the original lead animators and designers on He-Man and She-Ra.
Oh, wow.
So... Yeah, man, I'm like, you know what, it's just so much better and a blessing that I'm able to be in touch with these guys whose heyday was the very time period that Little Billy takes place in. So, like, the shows that he loves to watch in my cartoon, I've actually got guys from those shows working on the cartoon with me in some capacity, you know, either as artists or as creative consultants. I've got Bill Kopp as a creative consultant bringing it full circle, he was one of the four artists, there were only four, one of the original four artists that did the Simpsons shorts on the Tracy Ullman show.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I remember those. Yes.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, like, back to the evolution, they've come such a long way. They look so different. But they would literally, back to what you asked, they would take Matt's drawings and just have 1 week to make an animated short translating his drawings into actual functional animation poses and footage. So they said, you know, it was a crazy task. It was like a sweat box. And then Bill, because he got that much hardcore experience on that show, he went on to do the Roger Rabbit theatrical shorts, which are just amazing masterpieces. Like, back to those 7-minute cartoons with a trillion drawings that cost millions of dollars.
Oh, sure.
And he also, you know, created his own shows. He did Eat the Cat. He did Mad Jack the Pirate and Schnookums and Me. And he even animated the One Tales from the Crypt episode back when it was on HBO that was ever animated.
Yeah.
It was the Three Little Pigs in horror form. So
yes.
Real fun stuff. And these guys are working with me, and they're contributing art. You can pledge to get all kinds of fun stuff. And I just want to get these products into the hands of the fans, the people who miss the 80s animation or 80s movies. You know, I mean, look at Stranger Things. You've got a huge demand, a huge audience for that style of filmmaking and storytelling that was so, you know, sort of pioneered and really heralded in the 80s, like with the Goonies and E.T. and all these great things that Steven Spielberg and Richard Donner and these other directors were producing. You know, it was just all very heartfelt, deep core, emotional, like family, friendship, adventure-based stuff. And there were high stakes. I mean, there was super risky stuff, and a lot of these guys had to take huge risks. So that's what I'm trying to do with little Billy. I want to go out, you know, just go for broke, all out, and try to make a cartoon series and tell a story that really breaks molds and breaks ground and gets into the minds and hearts of people all over the world that have these different situations. So that's what the Indiegogo is aiming to do.
And now, obviously, you're trying to get the show onto television. And so it's not a web series. This isn't one of those little 5 or 6 minute deals. Ultimately, you'd like to put this thing, you know, right onto Fox or wherever, right?
Absolutely. Exactly. I want to create, you know, even if it starts off as a series of standalone independent short films, that are going to be released online, or at least could be, I want it to ultimately become a primetime series, even if it doesn't air on primetime network television, because that's certainly the original goal I had. But now with streaming and Netflix and all these wonderful platforms that are really changing and revolutionizing and dominating the way we view content and the entertainment market, I see Little Billy as really a product or a project, you know, that could exist anywhere. So, you know, it could be released on Netflix as a primetime series where it's the same half hour format. And, you know, you can choose to binge watch it or do one episode a day or a week, and then maybe syndicate it or have it air first on a channel, like a network TV channel or a web channel, and then syndicate it through Netflix or have some other form. I mean, there's so many options now with YouTube, Red, and all these different things, Vimeo. So, yes, it really, I want it to be like a major series, not just a short web series of, you know, short films.
Yeah, vignettes or whatever. So, yeah, no, that's you know, it's a lofty goal, but if anybody that can pull this off, it's got to be you, my friend, because I think you got it down.
Thanks, Rick. I appreciate that, man. I mean, I'm giving it my all, and I've been working on the project now for years. So, I'm just never giving up. You know, I believe in it, and I see that there's not only a demand for it, but a need for it now more than ever. You know, there's so many, you know, I guess, insecurities and things that sort of perpetuate the human, view of itself, like people's view of themselves is being very affected and influenced by lots of different things nowadays, because we've never had more screens and voices telling us what to do and who to be and how to think. And, you know, so, I mean, you've got this one that you carry around in your pocket all the time, and we're sort of bound by it and slaves to it if we're not careful. So it's like, well, look, since you've got all these different things feeding into that, you know, that train of thought, then why not have some positive content coming in with all the other crazy stuff, where you can actually have some balance between a lot of the sort of anti-hero, negative, just very sort of agenda-driven content that's being created and streamed nowadays. And I feel like it's a great opportunity to bring a balance to that and to just give people an alternative and like have a positive source of entertainment.
Oh yeah, well, Lord knows we need it. There's, you know, even yeah, I'm a cord cutter, so I'm on the streaming thing. But you know, there's still, you know, 10,000 things to watch, and it's, you know, it's like it's almost too much, but there's nothing really, you know, I don't know. I get a little picky about my television, you know.
Sure, I'm the same way. And I mean, the thing that really like stood out to me was that a lot of this stuff is very similar. You know, you have a whole bunch of, like, you know, you got reality shows, and they all sort of try to fit a certain profile or mold. You have, you know, the family sitcom, which is a lot more antagonistic and sarcastic than it used to be, at least in the animated world, with shows like Family Guy and American Dad, and, yeah, you know, to some degree, South Park and Bob's Burgers, like, and even The Simpsons sometimes. But, you know, they all have their own level and, you know, I guess, aspects of charm and appeal to them. which I think is why they've lasted so long. I mean, they're all going in, you know, I mean, they've all lasted longer than the first, than the Flintstones, which is what sparked this, you know, whole primetime animation thing to begin with. So the Flintstones, I think it was on for 6 seasons. And I think every show I just mentioned has been on longer than that.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, they're doing well, and they're tapping into, you know, a great market, and people love it. You know, people love these series, and I do too. I'm a fan. I just like the idea of some sort of alternative to the type of media that's being mass produced. So, you know, yeah, with all these options, I feel like it's a great time for Little Billy, and, you know, people have a way to view it anywhere they want, whenever they want, once it becomes a show. And so let's make that happen. You know, guys, if you can pledge to the Indiegogo at littlebilly.com, please. There's, you know, 10 days left. Remember, December 16th is the deadline. And if you can't afford to pledge, just tell somebody about it. Share the link, blast it out on social media. Let's try to get it to go viral. Cause there's power in numbers. You know, I mean, I keep the way I think about it is, like, you know, if 100,000 people pledged $1, I would have just gotten 10 times the goal I'm asking for.
Yeah, I know.
10,000.
When you look at it like that, it's like, this isn't that hard, but, you know, there again, we know the reality of it, but yeah, it is a numbers game. And that's why, you know, it's, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show, because, you know, to help you out with this, I believe in your project here. I think it's fantastic. And you and I've talked about it, you know, off air about this. And I told you then, and I stand by now, if there's anything we can do to help, I'm here. And if this is what of it, this is what we can do to help, by God, let's get it out there, and let's get some dollars in here to make it work for you. And wherever people download this show, there's going to be a link in the description of this thing at littlebilly.com. If, you know, if they're too lazy to type it in, they can click on the link and it'll take you right to it.
Beautiful, man. Thank you so much. That's wonderful. Yeah. And I'm just excited. I hope you guys like this trailer. And there's a pitch video with me giving a little bit more backstory and insight to the project and the goal. And there's more stuff coming too. I mean, I've got a ton of stuff backlogged for the final 10 days of the thing. So there's going to be an update probably every single day from now to the end of the campaign. And here's what's cool. Indiegogo has this new feature called In Demand, where if you meet your goal and you opt in for the In Demand feature, your campaign stays live after the deadline.
Aha!
So as long as you have your money raised by that last second, all that really happens is your deadline just goes away. The campaign's still live and active, and people can keep pledging. And as long as you keep posting an update, I think it's once a month, your campaign just stays live forever. And so it can become an ongoing thing. And so that's, you know, that's what I'm shooting for. It's because how cool would it be to actually show people behind the scenes of the process of animating this thing. I love the idea of doing live stream videos, of keeping the ball rolling with, like, you know, oh, here's a video update. Like, here's me animating Billy, like, running through this crazy maze of danger. But look, oh, he's gonna escape by the skin of his teeth. And just have, like, a lot of fun with actually the production as well as the content itself.
Oh, sure. No, that's brilliant. I love that idea. No, it just takes, you know, people to keep sharing it around and do your part, throw a few bucks in there. And you got some great incentives in there too. So, you know, there's a little something for everybody in there.
Yeah. Thanks, Rick. You know, man, I really appreciate you having me on the show to talk about all this and help get the word out and to bring it back full circle for all you Simpsons fans this weekend. Or soon, it may be even sooner than this weekend, I'm going to be releasing a special batch of Simpsons Treehouse of Horror posters that I dug out of storage. And I've got a handful of them that I'm going to sign and draw on that are going to be at a set price. And then I found just a few that were signed by the bulk of the Simpsons animation crew. And a couple of those include signatures for Matt Groening.
Oh, wow. Oh my, yes.
I'm excited to get those online and see, you know, if so there's only two with Matt's signature. So get ready, guys, because they're coming. If those are too rich for your blood, there's more with a lot of other signatures and drawings, and there's some fun stuff there already. So, I mean, just thanks so much for all your support and help, everybody.
Well, Chance, best of luck to you, my friend, and we'll stay in touch. And you know, we're looking forward to seeing little Billy showing up in my living room.
Hey, thanks, Rick. From your mouth to God's ears, brother. That is exactly what I'm going for. And thank you, man. Yeah, let's definitely keep in touch. I'd love to come back on the show, maybe to do some follow-ups, or hey, when this first episode or first short is actually done, maybe we could do like a review or just talk about it.
Sure. We'll do a spoiler cast.
There you go.
That'll be fun.
Awesome.
That'll be a good time.
Awesome.
Well, Chance, thank you, my friend, and stop in anytime, all right?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Rick. I'll do it. And everybody listening at home, remember, if you're not like the other kids, he's just like you, littlebilly.com.
The Broom Closet is your one-stop shop for all of your metaphysical supplies and gifts. We stock candles, herbs, gemstones, incense, salt lamps, and more. We also host monthly rituals and events for those looking to get together with like-minded people. And the Broom Closet is the only place you can get your cards read by me, Reverend Emily. I'm an ordained Wiccan minister and Reiki master. Book your next tarot reading and see what's in the cards for you. Discover conscious living and being connected to an awesome community. The Broom Closet Metaphysical Shop is located in downtown Memphis, or visit our online store at thebroomclosetmemphis.com. The Broom Closet, where magic begins.
Here's what's coming up on the next episode from Radioland with Rick Cheddar.
Mr. Josh McClain has joined us here in the studio.
Hello!
What's up, buddy?
Hey, man!
Don't you know right now out in Hollywood, Burt Reynolds and Jimmy Caan are having a drink going, goddamn, we got lucky.
Oh, man, dude.
We got lucky.
I can't imagine dating in this climate now.
No way.
Because I got married in the best time. Yeah. I found the love of my life at the best time, because if I'd have found out you could just do Tinder... You know, and that'd be it, and never ever have a relationship again at that point in my life, and all that coke I was doing, I'd have seriously thought about that. That would have been a serious contention.
Oh,
but,
big time, yeah.
But I do love the other side of all this is the fact that there are repercussions.
Yeah.
The fact that Netflix pulled in a second the Kevin Spacey show as soon as that happened.
Yeah.
The fact that DC backed up the Gal Gadot Wonder Woman when she said she wouldn't make another one because of Brett Ratner, that short, fat, doughy piece of shit. God damn it.
For previous episodes, go to radio-memphis.com. To download episodes to your mobile device, search the show in iTunes, player.fm, stitcher.com, Pocket Cast, or TuneIn. And now, here's more with Rick Cheddar from Radioland.
You know, as a testament to how this show is produced, you know, we don't really edit much of anything out. You know, I could have shortened that interview, but I didn't. I wanted it all out there because it's... Chance is a great guy. He's a great speaker. He's very well versed in what he talks about. And he's a fascinating dude. So I hope you enjoyed that end of it. That's why this show's running a little long. In fact, who cares? You got someplace to be? You're listening to this. Pause it. Come back later. It's time now, though, to get into a tune. Chance, of course, as I mentioned, is a musician. He's got a neat little album out that you can find on his website. If we talked about it, littlebilly.com. You can go there to learn more about the show, of course. And if you cursor down a little bit, you can find a copy of his record. It's neat. It's a lot of fun. So we're gonna play a cut off. The song is called "Chasing the Sunset" from Los Angeles, California. This is Chance Raspberry from Radioland. Chasing the Sunset is the name of the song. Chance Raspberry is the artist here from Radioland. You can find it on the record Old Souls, Young Hearts. It is available where sold, or if you donate to his Indiegogo campaign, you can get a copy of it. Yep, all the details are up there to add that to your collection of stuff, your collection of music, if you will. So, neat conversation with Chance. Great guy. We'll be hearing more from him. I want to do some more stuff with Chance, too, because he's just such a great guy and very well-versed when it comes to pop culture of the 80s and the 90s as well. And with a great project. Check out littlebilly.com for more information. So there you go. You heard what's coming up next time. It is Mr. Josh McLean as such. So until then, take care of yourselves, take care of one another, and quit shooting each other, okay? We'll see you next time. I'm Rick Cheddar, and this has been from Radioland.
Rick Cheddar from Radioland is produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. All music performed during this episode was used by permission. No part of this program can be rebroadcast or used in any other way except by written consent. For bookings and other inquiries, you can write the show by sending an email to radioland@pirateradiostudios.com. For more, go to radio-memphis.com.